Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Juliet Frumholt, filling in for Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll hear about a possible solution for dental care shortages in Ohio. We'll have a new Senior Voices story, Dayton Youth Radio, plus a preview of next weekend's WISO Serious event. Up first, a union representing Dayton school bus drivers has declared intent to strike after months of failed contract negotiations with the district. The announcement comes less than a month after the district narrowly avoided a teacher's strike. WISO's April Leslie has more.
If a deal is not reached, more than 150 drivers plan to strike on April 10th. That's a day after students are set to return to school after spring break. It would also coincide with state-required testing, according to a district press release. District bus drivers currently transport about 10,000 students to and from public, parochial, and charter schools. All of these students are younger than high school age. The Local 627 chapter of the OAPSE has been in negotiations with DPS since last June. Sticking points in contract talks include wages, benefits, and the district's process for tracking driver work hours. Over a crackling phone line, DPS Superintendent Elizabeth Lawley said the board is not planning to return to the bargaining table before the strike date.
The district has given all that they can give at this point in time.
Lawley says they are preparing a backup transportation plan in case of a strike. Details of that plan have not yet been released. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
The deadline to register to vote in Ohio's May 8th primary election is quickly approaching. Voters must register by April 9th by going to a local board of elections or registering online through the Secretary of State's office. There will be one statewide issue that could change the process for drawing lines for congressional districts, and voters will decide party primaries for candidates for all of the state's top offices, including governor. Ohioans who are 17 now but will be 18 by the November election can register now and vote for candidates in the May primary, but not for the issues. Transgender Ohioans who want to change their birth certificates to reflect the gender with which they identify are filing a lawsuit against the state over that policy. The ACLU and Lambda Legal filed the lawsuit. Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles has the details.
Stacy Ray is one of the plaintiffs. She says she was embarrassed, harassed, and threatened with physical violence after a human resources employee publicly noted the gender on her birth certificate does not match the gender on her driver's license and other legal documents.
I was referred to as the freak, and the female coworker said if she ever encountered me in the woman's restroom, that she'd beat me up.
Aaron Baer with the Citizens for Community Values says his group doesn't condone threats like Ray experienced, but he says the ACLU is sacrificing medical accuracy for political ideology.
What they're trying to force the state to do here is falsify medical records.
The ACLU says Ohio is one of only three states that has yet to change its policy on transgender people and birth certificates. Joe Ingles at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
More than half of Ohio counties don't have enough dentists for the population. Numbers show the dental shortages are especially severe in many rural and low-income communities. To close this dental care gap, some states are experimenting with a new approach. It's called dental therapy, and some advocates want the practice legalized in Ohio. They say it would make routine dentistry more accessible and affordable for the most underserved Ohioans. In today's installment of our Scratch Innovation Series, WISO's April Leslie explains the push for dental therapy is not without controversy.
It's a busy day at Sinclair Community College's dental clinic. Families are packed into the waiting room, and in the sprawling treatment area, there's a child in almost every exam chair. All of these kids are Medicaid recipients, and they're here for Give Kids a Smile Day, one of about 6 days a year when the clinic offers free children's dental services. Dr. Todd Baker is a dentist and adjunct faculty member at Sinclair Community College. He leans over a patient chair to examine the teeth of one squirming four-year-old.
All right, buddy, let's take a peek at your teeth in there. Okay, let's see you bite together there. Let's see you bite. Arr, bite together like... Yeah, awesome job.
Many children in Ohio go without care like this. In fact, more than 1 million children and adults in the state don't have access to regular dental services. A lot of people in this situation live in rural areas or lack transportation. Many are lower-income Ohioans who earn too much to qualify for Medicaid insurance. Others do receive Medicaid, but they have trouble finding dentists who accept them, partly because state reimbursements for services are so low. Ann Neighbor is a member of the Ohio Dental Hygienists Association. She says not seeing a dentist regularly can lead to severe and often expensive health consequences.
They end up in the emergency room with dental pain, dental infection. If they have to be admitted because it's such a severe infection, then, I mean, you're talking several thousand dollars. Dental infection affects your entire body. It affects your overall health.
Neighbor says many in the dental health community have been searching for a solution to this problem for years, and she thinks they may have found one. Dental therapists. Dental therapists are mid-level providers of dental health services, a little bit like nurse practitioners, but for the dental field. They have less training and are paid less than dentists, but they're able to perform some routine dental procedures dental hygienists and assistants can't. Dental therapy originated in New Zealand in 1921, and a handful of U.S. states have recently legalized the practice. Neighbor says in those states, it's resulted in healthier patients and lower costs.
There are now 54 countries that have dental therapists, and there have been around almost 100 years, and there are 1,100 studies showing that it does work.
Steve Wagner of UCAN Ohio, or the Universal Healthcare Action Network, says the use of dental therapists could help increase access to dental care in underserved communities and make that care cheaper for both providers and patients.
What that means for a practice is that the dentist then can concentrate on the more intense procedures, and the dental therapist can, you know, the lower reimbursed, but also the less, you know, the things within their scope, and practices can actually do better being Medicaid patients.
Senators Peggy Lehner of Kettering and Cecil Thomas of Cincinnati are sponsoring legislation that would legalize dental therapy and license dental therapists to practice in the state. Under the bill, dental therapists would work under the supervision of a dentist, but could perform 35 routine procedures independently. They'd also be required to serve lower-income Ohioans and others living in dental shortage areas. But not everyone is convinced legalizing dental therapy makes sense. The Ohio Dental Association has come out strongly against the legislation. Dr. Matthew Messina is a member of the Ohio Dental Association and a professor at Ohio State University's Dental School. Messina says allowing dental therapists to treat patients could be dangerous.
They're looking at trying to create a kind of dentist light, somebody with less training, and then empowering them to do procedures up to and including drilling cavities and extracting teeth.
Messina is in favor of another dental-related bill at the State House. That bill would give expanded capabilities to existing members of dental teams, like dental assistants. It would also increase funding for teledentistry, which allows dentists to see patients virtually through video chatting.
The therapist approach is a diversion from what's currently working and is rapidly improving. In an effort to try and do something that looks new or looks fresh and different, but actually the tried and true and stepwise process is working better.
The number of dentists in Ohio has increased over the past few years, but the number of dental provider shortage areas in the state has gone up too. In 2011, there were about 59 shortage areas. Now that number is closer to 100. Ann Neighbor of the Dental Hygienist Association says the increase could be attributed to population shifts and dental providers clustering in certain areas of the state.
We need a comprehensive therapeutic care that's affordable that everyone can get.
It could be a while before we see any changes to the state's dental care system. No hearings have been scheduled for either dental health bill. And even if state lawmakers eventually move forward with dental therapy, Neighbor says it could take years before dental therapists are trained and ready to see patients. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
This story is part of WYSO's Scratch Innovation Series. To submit your ideas about innovation in Dayton, visit our website, wyso.org. Coming up, a Senior Voices story about Dayton's Westwood neighborhood in the 1960s and 70s. But first, two perspectives on the opioid crisis, one from Side Effects Public Media and the other from a Dayton Youth Radio producer. That's next on WYSO Weekend.
Hi, Shake and Dave here, inviting you to join me at my new time on Sunday afternoon. You'll get all the rhythm and all the blues, the ones you've been accustomed to, just now in the daylight hours and just in time before the start of another work week. Tune in for Your Blues Therapy, the Hall of Fame Blues Show, now on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on 91.3 WISO and WISO.org.
This is Luke Dennis. We think we found the right ingredients for our Why So Serious party at Memorial Hall on April 7th. They include the Ruby Girls, plenty of Yellow Springs Brewery beer and Buckeye vodka, delicious food from Christopher's Restaurant, a box of feather boas, and some comedy sketches starring WISO staff. All that's missing is you. Tickets are at our website and quantities are limited. Thanks to our sponsors, including Equitas Health, Corner Kitchen, and MetLife agent Chad McCoy.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO. I'm Juliet Frumholt, sitting in for Jerry Kenney. When the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issue a report on the number of overdoses in the U.S., it's only as good as the data states send in. This year, the CDC reported that overdoses from opioids, such as prescription painkillers or heroin, jumped nearly 30% in 2016. More than 42,000 people died. But those are the deaths the CDC can definitively say were opioid-related. As Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media reports, the real number could be much higher.
So we are going back to what we call our receiving area.
Alfie Ballou is deputy coroner for Marion County, Indiana, and she oversees death investigations. When someone dies, an investigator from Ballou's office looks for clues.
We're going to look in that whole area where they were found. We're going to look in cabinets to look for syringes or other drug paraphernalia such as pipes, rolled up dollar bills, straws.
Items that could point to drug overdose as a possible cause of death. But to really know for sure that someone died of an overdose, investigators need to test bodily fluids. Ballou shows me inside a walk-in refrigerator where they store samples from people who have died. Blood and urine and the fluid inside the eye, known as vitreous.
We send that off to a toxicology lab to be tested for what we call drugs of abuse. Some prescribed drugs, definitely opioids, illicit drugs, cocaine, heroin, meth.
When all that information is in, the coroner fills out a death certificate. And if it's an overdose, they'll put that as the cause. But death investigators around the country don't always list the specific drugs involved. And that really matters. Christopher Room is a professor at University of Virginia, and he's published two papers on this topic recently.
In some cases, they're classifying it as a drug death, but they don't list the kind of drug that was involved.
If you don't specify that an opioid or cocaine or meth contributed to someone's death, that information isn't captured by the state or the CDC. And because of that, we are undercounting opioid-related overdoses across the U.S. Room says that big number from the CDC, 42,000 opioid-related overdose deaths, that number should be nearly 50,000. Indiana's count is especially off. Room estimates that the state's opioid overdose rate was actually twice as high as what the CDC reported in 2014.
There are other states that do very well. I mean, there are some states that have pretty much 100% reporting.
He says a major factor is who investigates deaths. In some states, like Indiana, every county has a coroner. Coroners are usually elected. They may not be medical professionals or trained to put specific information on death certificates. Other states have medical examiners, who are doctors. In some cases, there's a chief medical examiner for the whole state.
States that have centralized oversight with medical examiners tend to do better than those with coroners.
Another problem is that death investigators don't always test bodily fluids. Brad Ray is a researcher at Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs. Why are some coroners doing this and not others?
The cost is kind of the main thing that I've heard anecdotally. But the other is they're not required to, right? So if you're not required to pay for it and you're not required to report it, then why would you? So we need to change that.
Indiana lawmakers passed new rules this year to fix this. Starting in July, coroners will have to run tox screens for suspected overdoses and report the results to the state. And the state will help cover the added costs. More accurate data will likely make the opioid problem look worse as the numbers go up. But Ray says that could help the state access federal funds and keep better track of drug problems.
So we can see when trends are happening. We can see when there tends to be increases in cocaine and meth and decreases in opioids if that happens.
Alfie Ballou's team was already getting tox screens for suspected overdoses. But it wasn't until she went to a conference last year that she realized they need to include more information on death certificates. Now her team will list specific drugs.
So we'll say drug overdose or drug intoxication, with, and then we identify the drugs. So if it's five drugs that have caused or contributed to the death, then we put those five drugs down.
Blue plans to teach other coroners to do it the same way. Jay Carper, SideFX Public Media.
This story was produced by SideFX Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. Ohio is at the top of the CDC's ranking for drug deaths per state. The people who are left behind, parents, children, and spouses, carry the pain from these losses. For Dayton Youth Radio, here's Project Coordinator Basim Blunt.
Today's producer, Carmen Tibbs, told our youth radio class that Dayton, Ohio had the highest mortality rates of drug overdoses in America. I remember thinking, why would a 17-year-old know such a grim and compelling statistic about her community? Here's her story.
It was Tuesday, December 3rd, 2013. I was in the middle of my 8th grade year. I had just turned 14. I walked in from school and noticed something was different. My mom wasn't in her normal spot on the couch waiting for me. She was down the hall in my room. She sat on the bed and asked me to sit down. I could tell from the look in her eyes that something was terribly wrong. Finally, she stuttered, "Your dad. He passed away today." I started to sob uncontrollably. When I finally got control over myself, I asked, "Was it an overdose?" I always knew that he had a problem. Even when I was young, he never hid anything from me. It seemed impossible. Less than a week ago, my dad, my cousins, and I had been together. We'd had a movie and board game night, and we'd made popcorn with him, made fun of him as he did his infamous Kool-Aid dance. The last time I saw my dad, I thought he was high, when really he was just very sick. I yelled at him and left without even saying I love you. When my dad had passed, he had been clean for a year. That's what took me by surprise. He had been doing so well. The next few weeks are a blur. I remember helping to organize my dad's funeral. I picked the flowers, pictures, music. Then there was the viewing. I was conflicted, and I didn't know if I wanted to see him like that. I wore his favorite sweater with my jeans. I remember standing in the hallway leading into his room at the funeral home. There was a sign out front that read, "Brian A. Tibbs." It was a big room. The carpet was brown. The walls were white. But I couldn't see my dad's body because it was too far away. My family walked up and I followed. My head told me to leave, but my legs kept moving forward. There he was, my dad, only 34 years old, and he was lifeless, a shell of the dad I knew, pale and eerie. I know my dad was a good man, and he just made a bad mistake, one that cost him his life. His addiction or his death does not define who he was to me, because he was so much greater than that. My dad was my favorite person on the planet. When I went back to school, there were stares. Everyone knew, but no one knew what to say. I felt like I was tearing away on the inside. I withdrew, and I carried around his ID and the last letter I found in his room after he had died. Carmen, I'm writing this letter to you to tell you how much Daddy loves you. I had you when I was 19 years old and still learning the meaning of life. But honey, I promise, for this day forward, Daddy's gonna do the best I can and be the daddy you deserve. You are and always will be the best thing in my life. I love you, Daddy. I feel like I was cheated. I always just kind of push it in the back of my head. I don't really talk about it a lot unless someone brings it up. And I think that I kind of want to be able to talk about it. It bothers me that he never got to see me perform in Color Guard. He doesn't get to see me go to prom. He hasn't been able to watch me grow up into the beautiful woman I've become today. Which I know, sadly, is his loss, but is also mine as well. For Dayton Youth Radio at Centerville High School, this is Carmen Tibbs.
That was Daughter Strong, written and produced by Carmen Tibbs, a senior
at Centerville High School. Special thanks to Carmen's teacher, Trisha Rapak, and Jada Woods, our intern from UD here at YSO. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. This is YSO Weekend. This week on Senior Voices, Sharon Christian remembers growing up in Dayton's Westwood neighborhood during the 1960s and 70s. Sharon spoke with volunteer interviewer Barbara Gerla at the Wesley Community Center near where she grew up.
It was a great neighborhood to grow up in. I've heard different about it now, but when I was young, we used to go to the park all the time or go to the library all the time. Our church was in our neighborhood, so we could walk to church. There were corner stores that were more like family-ran stores of people that had lived in that neighborhood before you or mm-hmm. with you. I can remember kids could go out trick-or-treating without fear. And if you got in trouble, everybody on the street knew you were in trouble before your parents knew it. We have pride about our neighborhood. You don't throw your trash outside. You don't throw it out your car. Everybody watched out for each other. I remember having block parties, which I don't know if they still have today or not. The first time I caught the bus, it was in the right down the street. I remember going downtown to stores like Thaw's and Donnefeld's when I was a little girl, and they were going through the race. I don't think it's really called race riot in Dayton, mm-hmm. but when it was unrest, I can remember seeing that when you're in the army and the people sit at them with the gun thing, and I can remember them riding down the street. I was just amazed. I didn't really understand what was going on or what it was about.
How old, do you remember how old you were?
I think I was probably like 9.
Did your parents try and keep you away from all that?
Well, we were on the porch, so as a child, I can look back and realize that it was going on, but we were never involved in it as far as children. So what somebody down south probably went through, it never reached us. It never was of that magnitude that it was down south. I went to Meadowdale, and we were the first black kids bused to Meadowdale High School. We were the first ones. I was just in awe of it. You know, I hadn't really dealt with white people.
Sure.
And it was just amazing to be that close proximity with them. Pretty emotional. I remember riding the buses home.
What are the most important lessons you've learned in life?
That you're never too old to learn. My grandmother taught me that. Mm-hmm. Being here at the center, I've learned a lot that I didn't know. I'm kind of opening up to more things that I just never thought about. So, you know, when they talk about you start your second life after you finish working, I agree. You're not over the hill, you're just getting up the hill. So that makes a big difference.
That was Sharon Christian speaking with Barbara Gerla as part of the Senior Voices Project. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Dave Barber. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. This series is made possible through the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation. That's just about it for this edition of YSO Weekend. But before we go, today is April 1st, and there's a lot to celebrate. The April Fool's Day festivities will extend into next weekend when WYSO presents the third annual Why So Serious. It's Saturday, April 7th at Memorial Hall, and here to tell us more is WYSO's Development Director, Luke Dennis. Luke, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, of course. We have a lot of fun with this event because we spend all day listening to the news, making stories, filing news, and it's can be overwhelmingly serious. And that's why we'd agreed a couple of years ago that we wanted to own April Fools and all that that entails to create a signature fundraising event that replaces our old silent auction. So we've had a lot of fun writing the sketches this year. The Ruby Girls are coming back. And I'm telling you, if you've attended before, I think we have increased the comedy quotient for this year's event.
And there's a special theme this year following along with some things that listeners have been hearing on the air since February. It's YSO's 60th anniversary.
Yeah, we turned 60 in February. So the whole setup for all of the comedy sketches that we wrote with Joel Levinson, he's a local comedy writer, is this idea that we hired marketing consultants to help us stay fresh and hip and interesting for the next 60 years. They make a series of, you know, frankly, stupid suggestions. And predictably, you know, chaos ensues. So we kind of act out some of these scenes where we try new ideas to stay hip and fresh. And by the end, hopefully people realize that they probably like YSO the way it is.
And when you say we, you are talking about we. You, me, Nikki Dakota, Jerry Kenny, April Leslie, Nina Ellis, WYSO staff on stage with local actors and the Ruby Girls.
Yeah, we did not hire actors for the most part. These are the voices that you hear every day acting out comedy sketches. And we did hire two very funny local improv actors to play the marketing consultants. And there's one other YSO person I want to mention. Bill Felker of Poor Will's Almanac is acting in a scene. I won't say too much about it.
Yeah, but don't give it away.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
And in addition to the big show on the main stage of Memorial Hall, there is a party vibe to Why So Serious.
Yes. So doors open at 7 and you go right straight into the basement at Memorial Hall where there is a party waiting for you. Radio Basim will be playing funky music, great food from Christopher's Restaurant, coffee from Reza's Roast. So you kind of hang out downstairs. There's a photo booth. You can put on a boa and a hat and have your photo taken with your friends. Eventually, you make your way upstairs through the beautiful lobby at Memorial Hall and find your seat in the main auditorium where the show itself will happen, and that's at 9 o'clock. And then there's kind of a dance party at the end, too.
And, of course, it's a big undertaking to make a performance and a party like this happen, and once again, we have some great sponsors joining us to help bring this event to the Miami Valley.
Yes. I consider the Ruby Girls a sponsor because they lend their talents to help us raise money. Yellow Springs Brewery here in town is the presenting sponsor for the first time. Big thanks to them. And Forge Line Motorsports, a new relationship to YSO, based in Moraine, family owned. They've become the megawatt level sponsor for the event. And then we have 7 other sponsors at lower levels.
We're talking about Why So Serious, the 3rd annual celebration of WYSO, a comedic celebration. It's happening next Saturday, April 7th at Memorial Hall in downtown Dayton. Tickets are still available, both general admission and VIP at WYSO.org. Luke Dennis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Juliet.
That wraps up this edition of YSO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. I'm Juliet Frumholt. Jerry Kenny will be back next week. Thanks so much for listening to YSO Weekend. The Book Nook is up next.
Hi, this is Cindy Funk, and I hope you'll tune in to the Dear Green Place this Sunday. I'll have lots of great Celtic music for you, new, just-released music, and some with a bit of age on it that just makes it sweeter. Toes will be tapping the Dear Green Place Sunday at 1 p.m. on YSO.
Hi, I'm Sean Creighton, president of the Southwestern Ohio Council for Higher Education, also known as SOCHE. SOCHE is a big supporter of WYSO. Our internship programs connect local higher ed with local industry, and advertising on YSO gets our message in front of business leaders who are looking to build their talent pipeline. Truly, whatever your business, WISO has the audience you want to reach.
Underwriting on WISO gets your message in front of 70,000 weekly listeners. Learn more at the WISO website.